Lopez Nunez was loading groceries into his car at an East Charlotte Walmart on Sunday. He's seen videos circulating of agents chasing people down sidewalks and breaking car windows. He says he fears for his undocumented wife and newborn and is keeping them home this week.
If you really need to go outside, it's for an emergency. If you try to stay, just stay home. Yeah. Be safe. And don't open the door for ICE.
Agents have been seen detaining people outside laundromats, auto shops, restaurants, and churches. In a tense exchange on Sunday, residents and activists confronted agents outside an Hispanic supermarket on South Boulevard. Activists are calling on city leaders to bar agents from city-owned buildings and parking lots. It's unclear how long the operation will last. Nick Della Canale, WFAE News. Border Patrol Commander Greg Bovino has posted photos on social media of 8 people he says were arrested. He says they're undocumented immigrants with previous charges like DUIs, assaults, and larceny. But he didn't include anyone's name or birthday, which police usually make public, making it impossible to verify. When WFAE asked the Department of Homeland Security for detainees' names and charges, a spokesperson replied with a brief statement that gave neither. The spokesperson also did not answer WFAE's question asking where people have been taken, though immigrant advocates say detainees are likely being transferred to ICE custody, either in Charlotte or possibly Lumpkin, Georgia. Nick Della Canale, WFAE News.
I'm Julian Berger. Congregants returned to churches with large immigrant congregations Sunday, with the surge of U.S. Customs and Border Protection agents leaving. Families gathered to worship on Sunday morning at Iglesia Restauración Familiar, a Spanish-language Pentecostal church in Northwest Charlotte. But a week ago, the scene was very different. This is how it sounded in the parking lot. Pastor Rudy Lopez says only a handful of families showed up.
We had a rather low turnout, as people were very frightened by what's happening, and understandably so. So there was little attendance.
Like many other Spanish-language churches in the area, Iglesia Restauración Familiar is home to numerous immigrants, some undocumented. One woman at Sunday service reflected on the Border Patrol's presence in the Charlotte area over the past week. She recalled an agent following her as she drove and said she prayed he would stop. Lopez is one of many pastors who say CBP's operations in Charlotte go against biblical teachings.
There is an ask from the Lord that we extend good hospitality to foreigners. Our immigrant brothers and sisters were allowed by God to enter the country.
9 miles away in East Charlotte, Pastor Megan Argabright leads Amity Presbyterian Church.
It is my faith that requires me to respond and to be in solidarity with those who are being oppressed and harmed by this.
Amity Presbyterian Church hosts an English service and a Swahili service. Many Congolese immigrants call the church home. Last week, Argabright and the Swahili pastor decided to hold a joint service.
People will face injustice.
To ensure its African immigrant congregation was safe while agents swept the city.
We're like, no, we need to be together because a lot of our community, a lot of the African fellowship, though they're not, you know, Spanish-speaking Hispanic folks, they are still very clearly immigrants.
Carolina Migrant Network confirmed sightings of CBP agents in neighborhoods across the street from Amity Presbyterian Church, as well as near other nearby churches. The Grove Presbyterian Church sits off W.T. Harris Boulevard. Carolina Migrant Network reported multiple CBP sightings across the street at Easttown Market, where Compare Foods is located.
It's terrifying to know that your friends and your neighbors are afraid of being taken by masked federal agents and that there's nothing you can do to stop it.
That's Kate Murphy, Reverend at the Grove Presbyterian Church. Her team took security measures last week to protect its congregation.
We worshiped with all the doors but one locked. We had a person keeping watch at the door, and we had to make a plan for what we would do if agents came into the building and started grabbing people.
Services are in English, Still, Murphy says her congregation is about 10% Latino. Nationally, Latino Protestants are politically diverse and leaned right last year, despite Trump's promised immigration crackdown. A CNN poll found about 64% voted for Trump in 2024. But Murphy and other pastors say that even within congregations that may lean conservative, the recent immigration operations have stirred fear and raised questions about how faith should guide the response.
I call upon the president of this nation, President Trump, to take note that he has 3 years left. 3 years to pave the way to victory for the candidate that they will put forward as a party.
Lopez hopes Trump and the Republican Party will treat immigrants with greater dignity in the years ahead. Julian Berger, WFAE News. I'm Julian Berger. Charlotte Mecklenburg Police, Mayor Vi Lyles, and Sheriff Gary McFadden have all said the surge of Border Patrol agents targeting immigrants is over, with the out-of-town agents leaving Friday. But the Department of Homeland Security insists the Charlotte Web operation is ongoing. Carolina Migrant Network says they have received an average of 150 calls a day on their hotline reporting CBP sightings. Since Friday, they've seen an average of 30 calls per day, a noticeable drop. Still, on social media and in response to direct questions from WFAE, the Department of Homeland Security says the crackdown is, quote, not over and is not ending anytime soon. Carolina Migrant Network's Becca O'Neill calls that fear-mongering.
Assuming they're gone, they refuse to confirm that, which just serves to further terrorize communities that have been so devastated by this.
As of Sunday afternoon, Border Patrol Commander Greg Bovino says agents have detained 400 people since Charlotte's Web began. Julian Berger, WFAE News.
U.S. immigration officers detained some 400 people last month in the operation known as Charlotte's Web. But federal officials still haven't said who many of them are or why they were taken. One of those detainees was a 27-year-old Honduran man stopped on his way to a dialysis appointment. His family says they had no idea what happened until a video call came in from Georgia. Inside a small living room in North Charlotte, the blinds are closed and the curtains are drawn. A family huddles together on a couch while a baby rocks and chirps beside them. On the wall above them hangs a framed image of George Washington crossing the Delaware with the American flag billowing in the wind.
William? Escucha.
The family leans around a cell phone, straining to hear their 27-year-old son and brother, Williams Javier Toro Enamorado. He is calling from an ICE detention facility 360 miles away in Georgia. That's where he was taken after he left home on November 19th for a routine dialysis appointment.
William, tiene una tarjeta para depositarle, ¿verdad?
His sister, Elizabeth, is trying to refill his phone account before the call drops. Enamorado has end-stage renal failure, and he needs nearly 5-hour-long dialysis sessions 3 times a week. Missing an appointment can cause serious health problems, including death. But he says after immigration officers stopped him on his way to dialysis, they put him in a van and transported him more than 5 hours away without treatment. By the time he arrived in Georgia, his feet were swollen and his stomach felt sick. I wanted them to take me to the hospital the day I came here, he says, but they told me no. The next day, he says officers took him into a room and told him something worse, that he wouldn't receive dialysis unless he signed a voluntary order for deportation. I told the officer, if they give me dialysis, I'll stay and fight my case, he says, because dialysis is life or death. But he says the officer told him, no, if you want to leave, sign. If not, you're going to die here. Thinking about his newborn son and family, he signed. Only then, he says, was he taken to a nearby hospital for a shortened dialysis session.
That is classic duress.
Jeremy McKinney is an immigration attorney who took on Enamorado's case after being contacted by a local advocacy group.
To me, that would raise a whole variety of potential torts when you're talking about withholding medical treatment. In his case, he has end-stage renal failure.
In a statement to WFAE, the Department of Homeland Security called Enamorado a criminal illegal alien, citing past arrests for cocaine, marijuana, and other lethal drugs. But McKinney says Enamorado has never been charged with possession of anything beyond a small amount of marijuana when he was 18, and WFAE could not locate criminal records consistent with the government statement. DHS also said Enamorado chose a voluntary deportation, and that any allegation ICE withheld treatment to pressure him is false. Even still, McKinney says ICE has since agreed not to enforce the voluntary departure order and allow Enamorado's case to go before a judge. McKinney hopes to secure him a green card.
We think that he's eligible for and should be granted his residency and then close this case for good.
Still, the family says they're worried Enamorado isn't getting his full dialysis sessions. Back at home, Enamorado's stepfather holds the phone above Enamorado's 3-month-old baby, who smiles at his father on the screen. The family says Enamorado hadn't been working in recent months. He spent nearly all of his time at home with his child or going to dialysis, all while his medical bills mounted. They say he came to the U.S. a decade ago by himself, at 17 years old, seeking health care. The rest of the family followed, hoping to escape poverty and gang violence in Honduras and build a life here. It's why they hung the picture of George Washington on the wall. We came here to work, and nothing more, his sister says. And even if America has taken her brother, she says her feelings toward the country haven't changed.
Yo digo que pues no tiene nada que ver eso con el corazón de las personas. Hay muchas personas buenas.
It has nothing to do with people's hearts, she says, because there are many good people who are supporting us. People from here. Enamorado's stepfather, Mario, says he supports efforts to deport criminals, but he says his stepson doesn't fit that description. In this case, my son wasn't doing anything wrong, he says. He was going to dialysis, essential for his life. And he says he would ask immigration officers to look inward.
Porque antes de nosotros ser inmigrantes, también somos seres humanos. Sentimos igual que ellos.
Because before we are immigrants, we are also humans, he says. We feel just like them. He turns back toward the couch, where the family huddles around the cell phone. The call dropped, and Enamorado's minutes are used up. So they add a few more dollars to the account and wait, hoping the screen will light up again with his face from 360 miles away. Nick Della Canal, WFAE News.
I'm Julian Berger. A Charlotte man accused of assaulting U.S. Customs and Border Protection agents may no longer face charges. Federal prosecutors filed a motion Wednesday to dismiss the case against Cristobal Martos, who was charged last month with assaulting, resisting, or impeding federal officers. CBP agents allege Martos followed them during their Charlotte operation. Agents then pinned his car in on North Tryon Street, and they claim he struck an agent with his side-view mirror. Martos, however, said he was in shock and was trying to get away. A judge has yet to sign off on the dismissal for it to take effect. Martos had faced up to 8 years in federal prison if convicted. He could still face charges in the future if prosecutors file a new case. The U.S. Attorney's Office told WFAE it would not comment on specific prosecutions. Julian Berger, WFAE News.
It's All Things Considered on WFAE. I'm Nick Della Canal. Mecklenburg County voters yesterday said yes to increasing the sales tax to 8.25% to pay for a nearly $20 billion transportation plan that will dedicate money to roads, sidewalks, and bike lanes, as well as new rail lines and buses. The vote was closer than many expected, with the referendum passing 52-48%. And joining me to talk about the results and what's next is WFAE's Steve Harrison. Steve, it was a long night last night, but yes for MEC, the group that supported the tax, ultimately won. How did they do it?
Yeah, Nick, the transportation plan did well in the city of Charlotte, in mostly white South Charlotte neighborhoods close to uptown and in Black communities in and around Center City. The tax also won support in very diverse suburban areas like Steel Creek and University. And for fun, I looked up the precincts that supported the tax the most. The most supportive, Noda. After that, it was Davidson, then followed by Southend, UNC Charlotte, and Dilworth. And there's one common theme there, young voters. I think they want a Charlotte that has more options than just driving. And most of those precincts are places where the blue line currently runs.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And I think there was an assumption that there would be a lot of no votes in Matthews because the town was upset about not getting the Silver Line light rail.
Yeah, that assumption was correct. There are 6 precincts in the town of Matthews. The 5 precincts with the lowest amount of support for the tax in the entire county were all in the town. And there were also people voting no in East Charlotte along the path of the aborted Silver Line light rail. And those 2 areas had specific problems with the plan. But there are other parts of the county voting, and those areas are historically more conservative and anti-tax, like Norman, west of Interstate 77, Ballantyne, Mint Hill. They all voted no.
So in the end, this was a close race. Was that a surprise, given the financial advantage that Yes for MEC had?
I think so. At least when you go back to the fall, when the pro-tax campaign started, they spent at least $1.7 million, according to the most recent campaign finance report. And the opposition was led by Robert Dawkins of the progressive group Action NC. He said he spent about $6,000. Yes for MEC at one time talked about winning 65% of the vote, and the group was confident going into election day they would win by a larger margin than what we saw. The original half-cent sales tax in 1998 and the reauthorization in 2007 both passed by much bigger margins for comparison. But Nick, a win is a win. The transportation plan is now going to come to life.
So how quickly will this come to life? When will we see the new projects?
The first step is appointing the 27 members to the new Transit Authority Board. That happens this month. The tax is levied starting July 1st. And then there's a lot of grunt work to be done, transferring all of the assets and employees from CATS to the new Transit Authority. But the new authority can start buying new buses and hiring drivers to expand the bus system. That should start in late 2026. And around that time, the city of Charlotte and the Mecklenburg towns can start spending road money for things like sidewalks, bike lanes, street lighting, and intersection improvements.
And what about the trains? People always like to focus on rail transit, the biggest and shiniest projects. What is the timeline there?
The first project is the Red Line commuter train to Lake Norman. The city already owns the tracks, but it said it will take 8 to 10 years for that train to carry passengers. But the key thing to watch for is whether the Red Line gets a federal grant to pay for half of the construction cost and whether today's cost estimate of roughly $1.4 billion holds. Let's say, hypothetically, the Federal Transit Administration doesn't fund the Red Line, something it's been reluctant to do with commuter rail projects nationwide. The new authority can still build the train, but that means less money for other rail projects, the Silver Line, the streetcar, and a Blue Line extension to Pineville. But Nick, all of that's going to be decided in the 2030s.
That is a long way off.
Indeed.
Okay, that's WFAE's Steve Harrison. And a note, tomorrow on All Things Considered, we will break down changes on the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Schools Board and who won and lost with WFAE education reporter James Farrell. As Charlotte Pride celebrates 25 years this weekend, we want to revisit a lesser-known chapter in Charlotte's queer history. In the 1980s and 90s, the AIDS epidemic was devastating the city's gay and trans community, and a small gay bar in Southend became ground zero in the fight against the virus. Now, a rare trove of VHS tapes preserved by UNC Charlotte offers a vivid glimpse into that time and how the bar cared for its patrons in the face of staggering loss. The year is 1993. A disco ball spins inside a dimly lit bar as a drag queen in florals, polka dots, and a towering blonde wig steps to the mic.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Eileen!
The crowd sits in folding chairs at tables clustered around the stage. Tonight's entertainment, a mock beauty pageant that's not about beauty at all.
At this time, we're going to begin our 6th annual Miss $1.98, Most Ugliest Drag Queen in Charlotte pageant, which all proceeds go to Metropolitan AIDS Project.
The contestants strut out in teased wigs and blacked-out teeth. There's Helen Krabby, Sandra Rockhard, Matilda Kangaroo, a queen named Slutsky, and seated in the audience is another queen, Judy Jetson, looking very thin and frail.
Let's welcome Judy Jetson, everyone! She's been sick for a little while, but she's back with us, baby, kicking and ready to go.
The queens shuffle through the pageant categories, sportswear, talent, evening wear, Then the queens invite Judy on stage, not to perform, but to sit and hold a box for tips.
You know what? You don't have to do anything. Just sit here and look pretty, baby. What? That's all drag's about. Yeah. Sit here and look pretty.
Judy sits, her face gaunt beneath a blonde wig, and the music starts.
Let's give it up for Miss Judy Chet.
He was from Albemarle, and he died of AIDS.
Greg Brafford was the manager of this bar. It was called Olean's, and he remembers Judy. She was a young man in his 20s.
We knew she was dying, too.
The entire bar lines up to drop dollars in Judy's box. She hides her face as they embrace her one after another. The moment was captured on tape by the bar's DJ, a man named Mike Wendt, who set up a clunky VHS camera that night, mostly so the queens could rewatch their performances. Though the tape is sometimes blurry, it may be the clearest picture we have of Charlotte's queer community during the AIDS crisis, and it's incredibly rare given the community's secrecy at the time.
What you're able to see in these recordings is truly like a community, like a family of people.
Josh Burford is the co-founder of Invisible Histories, which documents queer history in the South. He learned of this tape and seven others in 2023 when Brafford, the bar manager, uncovered them in a box in his attic.
I had no idea those tapes even existed until that moment.
He had the tapes digitized and found hours of footage from inside the bar spanning several years, from 1989 into the mid-90s. There are scenes of pure mayhem, like in 1992 when a speaker catches fire during a group number. The queens never stopped dancing, even as staff rushed to douse the flames.
They burn the house down.
And there's tenderness in a 1989 duet with a bedazzled queen, Veronica Lee, and a handsome man in a suit, Lynn Cantrell. Brafford, the manager, also appears in the videos. He's often shirtless with a mustache, weaving through tables with drinks.
Yeah, that's me. One time I was skinny.
Now in a wheelchair, he watches the footage from his home in Mount Holly, pointing out old friends and remembering the crowd of misfits who would pack the bar on Saturday nights.
I mean, we had outlaw motorcycle guys, drag queens, a lot of lesbians. You got to realize that back then a lot of lesbians went to gay bars. Then you had straight guys. They were curious. Hustlers.
And that was Olean's, he says, Charlotte's original gay bar, founded in 1968 by a woman named Olean Love.
She was sweet, she was kind, and she was drunk every night.
Brafford first visited as a patron in the 70s, then became manager in 1984, just as the AIDS epidemic was reaching full force. When it came to Charlotte, Brafford remembers it hit Olean's hard.
Everybody that got sick died. And at one point, I lost 20 employees over 6 years. And it was a sad time.
He remembers that politicians were no help.
Our beloved senator from North Carolina, Jesse Helms, said AIDS wasn't a problem. It was a cure.
And so, he says, the bar was forced to take matters into its own hands. The staff and performers created a yearly benefit called the Carnival of Hope. It was a blowout weekend of drag shows, car washes, and yard sales that raised thousands of dollars for their friends dying of AIDS. And every year, the shows would pause for a candlelight remembrance, which we can now see in grainy footage.
Oh. Everybody have a candle?
Yes!
Everybody have a candle?
On one tape from the mid-90s, local drag legend Kacey King appears in a shimmering gold dress. She invites everyone to light a candle and call out the names of the loved ones they lost. One by one, the patrons step to the mic.
To Ernie Corbin and all my friends.
To Steve Vaughn.
To Marvel.
Huey Scott.
Leave the windows open.
Michael Good.
Someone in the crowd mentions Judy Jetson. Another remembers Brafford's best friend, Lynn Cantrell. Nearly everyone, it seems, has a name to remember. Watching the tapes back, Bradford's eyes grow cloudy. Tears streak his face.
We did it ourselves, as a community. And pretty good thing. Even after all these years, makes me remember. Makes me remember.
Anybody else? Please, please come and say it.
Keith Burvett and Ares Webster.
Casey King, the drag queen, died last November at 68. Bradford says most of the others in these tapes are gone too. So is the bar. Olean's closed in 2000 and was turned into a Baskin-Robbins. But in Bradford's mind, the bar remains how it was. The drag queens in sequence, the bikers, the misfits, filling the room with smoke and laughter and stubborn love in the face of loss. And on these tapes, they always will be. Nick Della Canale, WFAE News.
I'm James Farrell. It's been a year since the state Supreme Court heard the latest round of arguments on the long-running Leandro school funding case, and there's still no ruling. It's the latest chapter in a nearly 31-year saga. So what's really at stake, and what's taken so long? For as long as Jackie McLean can remember, Hoke County Schools has struggled to find resources. She first saw it as a parent in the 90s when her daughter couldn't take her books home to do homework.
They had science labs, but really had no labs. They had the room, but they didn't have the supplies and the tools. They had math, but they didn't have enough of math books. They didn't have enough of social studies books.
That was why in 1994, Hoke County Schools and four other low-wealth school districts across North Carolina filed a lawsuit alleging the state was failing to provide them enough funding for an adequate education. Now called the Leandro case, that lawsuit is still going on today. At stake are potentially billions of dollars in future school funding and questions about how to fix an education system that courts have long held is failing students. McLean is now a dropout prevention specialist at Hoke County Schools. She says places like Hoke County are still seeing the same challenges.
That's three different generations, right? So now we are dealing with the children of those children and even some of the grandchildren of those children. And the need increases with time.
The Leandro case has a twisting history of unorthodox court proceedings, complex legal questions, and a healthy dose of politics. There have been four state Supreme Court rulings, with a fifth on the way. Charlotte Mecklenburg Schools joined on to the case, but was also sued by a different set of plaintiffs. It's now listed as both a plaintiff and a defendant. Rob Leandro, the Hoke County student who became the case's lead plaintiff, is all grown up now. He declined an interview because he's now a lawyer at the firm that represents the school districts. So what's taken so long?
It was not like a conventional three-hour trial that we see on television leading to a verdict. This was, in fact, a long, long, long inquiry.
That's Jerry Hancock, a Raleigh-based attorney whose firm Everett Gaskins Hancock has worked as an advisor and lobbyist for the low-wealth school district since the 90s. In 1997, the state Supreme Court ruled that all North Carolina students were entitled to a, quote, sound basic education. For years, Wake County Superior Court Judge Howard Manning and his successors conducted an exhaustive inquiry, looking at Hoke County as a proxy case.
So Judge Manning went out and personally visited schools, talked to educators, did it frequently. He read widely. He held many, many hearings.
By 2004, Manning's trial had produced at least 400 pages worth of decision memorandums and over 50 boxes of exhibits and transcripts. But in the decade that followed, rather than order any specific fix, Manning and his successors tried to push state leaders to fix the problem, with little success, argues Jane Wettick, a retired Duke law professor who's filed amicus briefs in the case.
The various judges that have been involved in the case have time and again given the state, sort of writ large, all the branches, but mostly the executive and the legislative branch, every possible opportunity to fix the problem.
In 2021, Democratic Governor Roy Cooper's administration agreed to a multi-year, nearly $6 billion roadmap to recruit qualified educators and provide equitable funding. But the Republican-led General Assembly was reluctant to enact it. When Superior Court Judge David Lee ordered the state treasurer to release $1.7 billion to cover a portion of the plan, Republican legislative leaders appealed, saying the General Assembly has ultimate power over the state budget. In November 2022, the then-Democratic majority state Supreme Court sided with Lee and ordered the release of funding. Courts typically don't revisit their own decisions without some change in the underlying facts of the case. But what changed on Election Day just 4 days later was the political makeup of the Supreme Court. Republican leaders appealed again in 2023. The newly elected Republican-led court agreed to hear the case again. It's been a year since the state Supreme Court heard those arguments, and there's still no ruling. The amount at stake has been whittled down to around $678 million. But many education advocates argue the case is really about forcing the state to commit to fixing an underfunded educational system. Here's Hancock again.
You have to worry if the way we were designing and funding our schools might be maintaining a permanent underclass in our state that would be doomed to repeat the cycle of poverty that their parents and grandparents had been caught in.
Others disagree. Mitch Kokai of the conservative John Locke Foundation says the case isn't about education funding as much as it is about precedent, whether the court should be able to force the legislature to adopt and fund a statewide education plan.
At this point, the most important part of this case is its relationship to the rule of law, because one of the most recent rulings in this case from the trial court level basically said that the state education agencies are going to be funded in large part by a decision from a single judge rather than through the normal political process.
In Hoke County, McLean leads me through the labyrinthine campus of Hoke County High School to her office. The school is a smattering of separated, aging buildings scattered on both sides of Bethel Road in the city of Rayford. Her side of campus was built in 1960.
This is where I live during the day. This is my hut.
She's standing in front of one of three run-down standalone structures, like small one-room houses. The one next to hers is abandoned, too dilapidated to hold any programming. Construction on a new high school that will replace this older section is underway, but it only scratches the surface of the needs of a growing district. Only two of the district's 13 total facilities were built this century. Five of the district's eight elementary schools are at least 60 years old. And like many other districts in the state, it lacks qualified teachers. In a district with less than 10,000 students, Hoke currently has 77 certified teacher vacancies. I asked Bill Harrison, the former superintendent of Hoke County Schools who actually filed the lawsuit in 1994, if he ever thought at that time they'd still be litigating it today.
Absolutely not.
Harrison himself represents one of those Leandro paradoxes. He went on to serve as chair of the State Board of Education, meaning he's technically been both a plaintiff and a defendant in the case.
We had no clue, no idea that we'd still be talking about it 30 years later.
In the Supreme Court's second Leandro decision, the court itself remarked, quote, "One can only wonder how many additional teachers, books, classrooms, and programs could have been provided by that money." That was an observation made in 2004, 10 years into the litigation. It's still relevant now, 20 years later. James Farrell, WFAE News.
Charlotte Mayor Vi Lyles has ordered more security and fare enforcement on city trains after last month's fatal stabbing of a Ukrainian woman, Irina Zarutska, on the light rail. The killing sparked a national firestorm after the release of surveillance video, which showed the attack happening without warning. I took a ride on the light rail to find out how the murder is changing the way some riders think about public transit and how to keep it safe.
Please stand clear. Doors are closing. Train is about to move.
It's late morning inside a northbound train on the Charlotte Blue Line. A young woman, Ellie, sits against a window, backpack at her side. Like many others, she watched the video of 23-year-old Zarutska boarding the light rail the night of August 22nd, and minutes later, being stabbed to death by a man seated behind her.
Yeah, I was kind of
just angry at the fact that no one really helped her.
The video has made her think twice about where she sits. She rides the train almost daily to school and uptown where she skates, and says riding at night can feel different.
Honestly, yeah, sometimes it's just the people are sketchy. Really sketchy.
She thinks more security could help, but also says the killing felt random, like it could have happened anywhere. And for now, she's not avoiding the train.
I mean, honestly, it's nothing I can do. I gotta take public transportation one way or another.
After footage of the murder was released and gained national attention, Mayor Vi Lyles ordered more security officers, police patrols, and fare enforcement along the light rail. Police say the suspect, 34-year-old DeCarlos Brown Jr., was riding without a ticket.
This stop is Charlotte Transportation Center and Arena Station. Please exit right.
Inside another car, John Youngblood finds a seat beside a window and balances a hard hat on his knee. The uptown scenery whizzes behind him.
I'm coming from work. I work at the airport, and I made it home up in North Carolina.
He says the video was hard to watch, and it made him angry.
He reached over and stabbed her to death while other passengers watched. That's horrific.
He wished someone had intervened or called for help faster. And he's not convinced that fare checks alone will change much. He recently saw a couple get kicked off for fare evasion.
And then when they put them off, they got off and hopped right onto the next train. So, I wish they could do more with that, but it's only so much they can do.
He said he wants more aggressive policing on city trains. Transit advocates have noted this is the first killing on the light rail since it opened in 2007. And some writers say the killing might have more to do with the courts. Brown had been arrested 14 times in 18 years and served prison time for armed robbery. In January, after a misdemeanor arrest for misusing 911, a judge released him on a written promise to appear and ordered a mental health evaluation.
The light rail is just one kind of place. There's many places in Charlotte where this can happen.
Standing near the doors, Lonnie, who only gave his first name, said he thought the court system and the judge who released Brown deserved scrutiny.
If they are causing that much, like, violence and stuff like that, if it's actually, like, physical violence and hurting people, then I think the courts really need to take into account whether they should be in the public.
Nearby, Dio Fabua is sitting with his back to a window. He says the killing has definitely changed the way he rides the train.
I rather sit with my back against the wall, nobody behind me. Yeah, that's why I'm sitting here. I just made a note to myself not to sit with anybody behind me, not anymore.
He says he wants people in power to stop pointing fingers and instead work together.
I don't think we can pick and choose who's responsible. It's everybody's responsibility. The light rail system have to make sure we have a safe environment to ride in. The police have to make sure the citizens are safe. Lawmakers need to make sure they have the necessary funding and things like that. So I think all of them need to come together to make it safer.
Nick Delacanal, WFAE News.